Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What criteria can be used to measure how Americans are really doing? While some assessments rely on gross domestic product to judge the well-being of the people in a particular country, my guest today is convinced those numbers fail to go deep enough into how a nation's resources are distributed among its people and across geographic regions. Kristen Lewis is director of the American Human Development Project, which looks at longevity, income, and education according to gender, ethnicity, and place, and finds that serious gaps remain between the best and worst off in the United States. Her new book, written with co-director Sarah Bird Sharps, is called The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Kristen, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Start by talking about what these GDP-based measures of well-being tend to overlook.
Well, economic indicators like GDP answer a really important question, which is, how's the economy doing? And of course, that's something we need to know. But the American Human Development Index answers an equally, if not more, important question, which is, how are ordinary people doing? And the way we answer that question is by an index that's a composite measure of health, education, and income indicators. And those areas are sort of the basic building blocks of a good life.
Do you find that using sort of raw data works better than these surveys that ask people how they're doing?
That's a very interesting question. There's been a lot of attention lately to subjective well-being surveys and measures. And they say a lot of interesting things. Our index is an objective measure, you know, using official U.S. government data. And, you know, it tells a very different story. Subjective measures are, of course, really important. How are people feeling? How are they evaluating their life? But they can come up with some counterintuitive findings. So on those indices, for instance, some of the states where subjective well-being is highest, people are saying they feel the best, and are actually areas where incomes are low or educational attainment levels are low and where life expectancies tend to be short, whereas some of the states that are reporting the lowest levels of sort of happiness, if you will, are the states where those indicators are highest. So it's hard. You couldn't really use it for, say, policymaking, right, because then you'd be investing money and making things better in Connecticut, which is, say, the top-ranked state on our index.
Yeah, they can be miserable and rich for a while.
Yeah, apparently anyway. Their money is not buying happiness, right?
So what you aim to do here is a sort of apples-to-apples comparison. I wonder if you can talk about the challenges, given that you mentioned that it's U.S. government data, and I'm guessing most of it comes from the federal government, but individual states and counties have different, sometimes, measurements for the exact things that you're looking at here.
Yes, that is a tricky issue. You know, there are always trade-offs when you have data because you want it to be able to be comparable across time and space, so you can make these apples-to-apples comparisons. So fortunately, the American Community Survey, which is a Census Bureau exercise, comes out every year, and it gives us the information we need for health and education by state, by racial and ethnic group, and by congressional district. So that's great. And then life expectancy, that's our biggest challenge because that's another one of our indicators, and we actually have to calculate the life expectancy ourselves using raw death data that we collect sometimes from the CDC for the national reports and then also from state health departments.
It's pretty remarkable that as a nation we have gained fully 9 years of life expectancy since 1960.
Yeah, it is. It is amazing. And one thing, it's amazing and it's great news. And two things to say about it. The first is that even though over the last 2 years what we've been talking about is health insurance, and we've had a big debate about health insurance and health care, those life expectancy gains that you see were not just driven by better health care, but rather by other things, the social determinants of health. So much less smoking, better diet, less childhood illness and childhood disease, things like that. Those are the things that really drive life expectancy increases. So it's interesting. And that's the first thing. The second thing I'd say is that, yes, we've made really quick progress, but other affluent democracies have made faster progress than we have in that area.
And in 2010, the biggest threats overall to our health are all things that appear linked to behavior. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Can I just step back one second, just to tell people really what the index is made of so that they understand what we're talking about here. Our index, as I said, measures health, education, and income. So health we measure using life expectancy at birth. Education we measure with educational attainment, so the highest degree adults age 25 and older have attained, and then also school enrollment for everyone age 3 to 24, sort of the whole school age, including preschool. And then the standard of living we measure using median personal earnings, so the wages and salaries of the typical worker age 16 and above. And then we put those three sets of numbers together, we divide by 3, and we get a score on the scale of 0 to 10. So that's just so people have the context of what we're actually measuring. In terms of health, yes, the big threats to our health and the things that are cutting our lives short, unfortunately, are these behavioral risks, especially what we're calling the fatal four risk behaviors. So smoking, poor diet, physical inactivity, and excessive drinking. These are the true leading causes of death in the United States. And minimizing them through prevention programs as well as by creating neighborhood, school, and work environments in which healthy choices are not just, you know, possible but also probable is what we really need to do to tackle that.
What's so interesting about that, Kristen, is that, you know, we have been spending so much time the past couple of years talking about access to health care, to medical care, and these seem to be things that could theoretically be corrected without someone necessarily seeing a physician.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we've spent the last 2 years really wrangling over healthcare, right? And in that time, the biggest health challenge we face, which is this yawning life expectancy gap between different groups of Americans, first of all, that exists, and second, these fatal four risk behaviors really didn't come up. So, you know, medical treatments are critical. They're, of course, very, very important. Once you get sick, you need access to healthcare, and that's a critically important thing for an affluent democracy to, you know, provide to all of its citizens. But it's better just not to get sick in the first place. You know, we're dying of chronic disease, and chronic diseases are really fueled by these kinds of sort of the situations of your daily life. So not just these risk behaviors, but also the conditions, you know, into which people are born and grow up and work and grow old, and the social and economic big disparities that exist. That's really what is breeding ill health of different groups. So, you know, things like chronic stress, neighborhoods without places to exercise or buy healthy foods, all these kinds of things are really the things that are cutting our lives short right now. Not by and large, not for everyone, but by and large, that's what's cutting our lives short.
Given the history of this country and in fact, of the entire world, people might be surprised to learn that overall in the United States, women today are doing better than men.
They are. Women are doing better than men. And again, our index is made of three parts. So on health, women are doing significantly better than men, living about 5 years longer overall. Though when you look at different racial and ethnic groups, the gap is at different sizes in different groups, but there is that gap. Women are living longer. And women's score on our educational index is higher. So women are enrolled in school at a higher rates than men. And women's educational attainment, especially the most recent generations, are much higher, are higher than men. So women are more women are going to college and completing college, for instance. In the younger sort of younger people, so that's the good news for women. The bad news for women is that men are still earning more. So in the country as a whole, it's an $11,000 earnings gap between men and women. And given that the median personal earnings that we're talking about are only about $35,000 for all workers, $11,000 is a pretty significant sum.
And since 2000, median personal earnings really haven't changed very much at all.
No, they haven't. They've stayed pretty flat. And in fact, they've inched backwards overall and in many parts of the country more than others. But yes, they haven't. And in fact, if you look at the trend between, say, GDP, to get back to what we were talking about at the beginning, GDP versus personal earnings, since the mid-1970s, the GDP of the country has about tripled. So that's the good news. But the wages and salaries of the typical American, these median earnings, have stayed pretty flat and have increased a little bit, but not very much. And then since 2000, have actually sort of inched backwards. So it's telling a different story. those two numbers.
Does that actually mean that we are as stressed about money as we have been? And I know the past couple of years have been a sort of a terrible aberration, but a lot of consumer goods and food are, relatively speaking, cheap in this country, in part due to the amount of things that we import from overseas.
Yes, I mean, that's definitely true. So if you look at an absolute scale, the material standard of living in the United States has of course improved because of cheaper goods and so forth.
How do you define resilience?
Well, we think about resilience really as the ability to bounce back, you know, to bounce back from crises. I mean, everyone is exposed to things like a storm, like Katrina, for instance, is an excellent example, or the most recent, this financial crisis we're just clawing our way out of right now. Those kind of large-scale catastrophes affect everyone. But people who go into them with more capabilities, sort of more things in their toolbox for living a life of choice and value, emerge much stronger. So if you just take the recession, for example, in the last quarter of 2009, workers who had a graduate degree had an unemployment plus underemployment rate of about 7%. But workers who did not graduate from high school had an unemployment rate of 35%. Underemployment and unemployment rate of 35%, five times higher. So even though, yes, all Americans have been affected by the recession, people who went into the recession with less education really, really felt the brunt of it.
So is that the best way to sort of shore ourselves up against future downturns, is to better educate the population?
It's certainly one way. It's certainly one way. I mean, that's all over the world. Higher levels of education are associated with not just higher salaries, which they are, but also longer lives. So in a sense, when you have more education, you become more resilient and more flexible, more able to deal with shocks and stress. And, you know, your education is something you always have with you, right? It doesn't get wiped out like your savings, in a sense.
Why is endemic poverty so difficult to climb out of?
Well, it's for a lot of reasons. And again, just looking at the index, people who are really poor, it's not just a question that they don't have enough money, right? I mean, that's one part of it. But often these things go together. So people who aren't earning high incomes also often are not having high levels of education. They're living in neighborhoods where the schools aren't very good, where life is very stressful. People with less education, less income tend to be in worse health. So it's because there's no silver bullet. I think that people, when they look at poverty, want a silver bullet. They want to say, okay, it's this one thing, and that's going to solve everything. And, you know, it's a lot of things. It's a lot of things at once, in a sense.
Does it work the other way if you are able to, say, give your children a middle-class childhood? Are they likely to stay middle-class for the rest of their lives?
They're much more likely to be able to stay middle-class. Especially, you know, the research shows that that's especially true for white Americans, mm-hmm. and it's somewhat less true for African Americans, though. African Americans are more likely than people in other racial and ethnic groups, the research shows, to, if they're born middle class, to not stay in the middle class. But it is better. I mean, especially those early years, the very early years. I mean, that's why we really emphasize the importance of early childhood education, because what happens to you in the early years of your life really sets the trajectory of your whole life. So deep poverty in early childhood is tremendously detrimental for your long-term health, for your long-term educational prospects, for your earnings prospects, for your likelihood of marrying, all sorts of things.
Kristen Lewis is my guest. She's co-director of the American Human Development Project. Her new book is called The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. We'll talk more after this break. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can get to us via email to think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is co-director of the American Human Development Project, Kristen Lewis. Together with Sarah Bird Sharps, her new book is called The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Julian in Dallas who writes, the correlation between social behaviors and life expectancy can better be expressed as the direct relationship between wealth and life expectancy. The wealthy have a better diet, they smoke in much smaller numbers, they're less prone to chronic stress in life. Everyone is not living longer, the rich are living longer. Is that true, Kristen?
There definitely is what's called a social gradient. So basically, the higher your status in society, the longer you live. And that's true in the United States, it's true all around the world. There's not a direct correlation between money and living longer. It's more that you're able to, as your writer suggests, you're able to create the conditions of your daily life that are more likely to optimize your health outcomes. So you're able to afford a better diet. You have the resources and the time, perhaps, and the information and knowledge to prioritize exercise. You maybe live in a safer neighborhood where you can walk and bike outside in safety, and you have access to full-service grocery stores and things like that. And then also this idea of stress. I mean, I think in the popular imagination, you think of the stressful thing. It's like the bottom of the ninth with, you know, two outs kind of situation. But that's not really the kind of stress that's harmful to your health. The kind of stress that's harmful to your health is this kind of chronic stress, being not having a lot of control over your time and being maybe in a work environment where you're not treated with respect and so forth. So, again, people who are are more affluent and better educated and so forth are less likely to have that kind of chronic stress in their life.
If you break these data down into their effect on different racial and ethnic groups, it turns out that Asian Americans overall are best off and Native Americans fare the worst. First of all, what do Asians in general have going for them?
Well, they have a lot going for them. I mean, first of all, let me just make one sort of statement, which is that all of these racial and ethnic categories, they come from the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, and they are the categories that the Census Bureau uses as well, and they're the categories that organize all the data that we use, so that's why we use them. Mm-hmm. These are, of course, really broad categories, right? Asian Americans can be Korean Americans who have been here for generations, or they can be recently arrived Hmong immigrants, for instance, from Laos. So there's huge variation within the category. That said, there are still great big differences between these groups. So Asian Americans have the highest levels of educational attainment by far than any racial and ethnic group. So that's one area in which they are really, really outliers in a positive way.
Does that speak to a cultural emphasis? And again, I know we're generalizing here, but in the Asian American community on education that other ethnic groups don't match?
I mean, it's something is causing it, and that's a possible explanation, certainly. I mean, if educational levels the educational levels of children are very predicted by the educational levels of their parents, right? So the best way to optimize kids' education is to give them parents who have a college education already. And Asian Americans tend to come to this country with higher levels of educational attainment, and thus are better able to support their kids' outcomes in school and so forth, positive outcomes in school.
I'm glad that you mentioned the Hmong immigrants because, in fact, even in this category where overall Asian Americans seem to be doing the best, that can mask the truth for certain groups, subgroups within that community.
Yeah, definitely, and that's critically important, and that's why we try to disaggregate as much as we possibly can. So our index as a whole ranks all the 50 states. Then it also ranks the 435 congressional districts. And, you know, congressional districts are, you can make apples-to-apples comparison with space because they each have about 650,000 people. Then we also look at racial and ethnic groups and the country as a whole and also state by state. And then when we do state-level reports, which we've done in Mississippi and Louisiana, And we're working on one right now for California, which is going to come out in the first quarter of 2011. We also go way down, you know, down to either county groups or groups of, you know, within big counties, splitting up those big counties, because that's really what tells you the big story. You know, the U.S. as a whole has an index score on our scale of 0 to 10 of 5.17. You know, that doesn't mean anything. It only becomes interesting or important when you see, you know, that, that one state is at 7 and another state is at 3, for instance.
Mm-hmm. It was disappointing to read that overall in the United States, we in Texas rank 38th in terms of overall well-being, at least according to the American Human Development Index. We have the very lowest high school graduation rate in the country in this state. Is that what's dragging us down?
Yes, it is. I mean, that's basically the area. So in our most recent national rankings, Texas, as you said, ranked number 38. The life expectancy outcomes are not that different than the national average, very near the national average. So people in Texas can expect to live on average 78.3 years, which is just a few months shy of the national average. And the median earnings, which are the wages and salaries of the typical worker, are only slightly below the national average. But the challenges lie in the areas of school enrollment and educational attainment. So as you said, the state is number one in terms of adults age 25 and older who did not complete high school. So it's 1 in 5 adults in Texas today don't have a high school degree. So that's just that's the highest rate. Mississippi and California are right behind.
And of the major metropolitan areas in the country, the top 10, Dallas is 9th, just above Houston, which comes in at 10th. We know that this area has plenty of wealth, plenty of educated people. So we're living in one of those places, I guess, where the divide between rich and poor, which is something that you found nationwide, is particularly broad, that the same region can have some of the richest and some of the poorest people.
Yes, that's very true. So we found that in every city. You know, as you noted, we ranked the 10 most populous metropolitan areas. And together, these 10 most populous metropolitan areas make up 25% of the country's population. And in all of them, we found these tremendous divides in terms of well-being. And often, you know, right within the same city, you're seeing the biggest divide. So if you just take Texas, for instance, as a good example, and you look at Texas's congressional district number 7 versus Texas congressional district number 29, that's the top and the bottom district in Texas. Congressional District 7 is the sort of affluent suburbs to the west of Houston, and the bottom, Texas 29, is the areas that lie just to the east of Houston. So this is a major metropolitan area. They're both within the same major metropolitan area, and yet there you're seeing these huge gaps.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Kristen Lewis about The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Let's go on the phones now to Robert in Fort Worth. Hi, Robert.
Yes, good afternoon, Ms. Lewis, Ms. Boyd. Okay, I'm not a native Texan. Okay, you can probably tell. However, I've lived in a lot of different places. And there's a reason why Texas is number 38. I have two daughters. As regarding education, I have two daughters in our local suburb of Fort Worth, and they're attending a public school, middle school and high school. The high school, it's an interesting, here's an interesting case in point. The high school has, my oldest daughter's high school has a football stadium that equals a professional football stadium. Now, the suburb where I live near, they're all working people, blue-collar people. And when I asked some of the school leaders regarding, you know, where did they get the funding to build such a big school, they said it was mostly, the money was mostly donated, raised from local residents. They can build a football stadium that mirrors a professional stadium, but they can't afford math books, and they're afraid they'd have to pay, you know, replace the math books if the math books get destroyed or lost.
Well,
that's one example. Then we have the environment. We have independent drillers that have more power over the legislators
Robert, and let me stop you there, and I appreciate your call, but we're not talking about the environment this afternoon, so we'll get to the question about education, because I think it's a really interesting one, and I'm glad you made it. You've talked to people now all over the country, I'm sure, Kristen, about this project. Is this a complaint that is unique to Texas, that there is a huge emphasis on sports? And I'm guessing maybe, I'm going to assume here, that the laboratories in Robert's daughter's schools are not equal to Bell Labs or something.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, it's something that... I think that, you know, in a democracy, people have different values. They value different things. Some people might value sports more highly than academic achievement. That said, in terms of your choices and options in your life, you'll have many more choices and options if you have a really solid high school education and you're able to enter a skilled trade or go on to college. And not very many people end up being professional football players, you know. It's a small segment, so it's a wonderful dream to have for your child, and a lot of people have that dream, but it's not statistically your best bet.
Well, and it is interesting because we've talked about, you know, physical inactivity is a huge problem, but in most cases, these competitive sports are not played by every student, as you mentioned, even in middle school and high school, a select few actually get that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem for the average person is really physical inactivity. I mean, in doing the research for this book, I just came across the sort of mind-numbing statistic that the average kid is spending 7.5 hours every single day in front of a screen.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, either a, you know, computer screen or playing video games or whatever. And, I mean, 7.5 hours, that's a lot of time.
That's as long as you'd think they'd be awake if they were outside of school.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you take them, and that's not counting school time or anything. That's things they're doing at home. So, you know, all of the research shows that kids need at least, you know, an hour of physical activity every day, playing, running around, even standing up. I mean, the research is even showing that even just standing versus sitting is much better for your health. And you're about as inert as you can get when you're just sitting in front of your screen.
Talk about why you place such emphasis on the importance of universal pre-kindergarten. What do we know about the long-term effects of having a year or two of schooling before kids enter kindergarten?
Well, research shows, and overwhelming and mounting research shows, that preschool education is the single most cost-effective and beneficial investment that we can make as a society. You know, you think of preschool and you think, okay, so preschool is going to get my kid ready for school. And partially that's true, that the preschool does get your kid ready to school, but it's more that it gets kids ready in terms of their behaviors and their ability to be in class, to focus, to concentrate, to control their impulses, to do all those kinds of things. And the big impact you see over the lifetime of preschool is really unbelievable. So some studies have shown that high-risk kids who took part in a high-quality preschool with college-educated teachers and a low teacher-student ratio, that the lifelong effects of that experience were really incredible. So those kids were much less likely to have spent any time in jail or to require public assistance than other kids in their same neighborhood who weren't engaged in the experiment. They were more likely to marry, more likely to own a home, more likely, obviously, to have completed higher education, and more likely and earning higher incomes. So it's a tremendously beneficial thing. I mean, what it does basically is it just sort of sets the trajectory of your whole life a little bit higher, and those little differences in the early years can make a huge difference over the course of your life, because education, of course, is a cumulative thing. You know, it just builds on what came before. So if you started a deficit that's never corrected, your sort of overall trajectory of achievement is really lowered.
So it's got to be far cheaper to put a child in preschool for a year or two than to incarcerate that child 20 years later for the same amount of time. Why then is universal preschool such a tough sell to lawmakers and to taxpayers at the same time that many people are eager to invest in incarcerating people?
I find that puzzling, and I wish I had an answer so that I could, you know, help better understand how to change people's minds about this. I guess it's a couple of things are possible. I mean, one is that politicians are on a 2 to 4 year time frame. And you don't see these overwhelming benefits of preschool for, you know, 10 or 20 years. and it's hard for people to kind of get that in their mind. I think it's hard to understand. I think when people think of preschool, they just think of school readiness, you know, wanting your kid to know the colors and learning how to count and things like that, you know, which isn't important, but it's so much bigger than that. It's really about socialization. So that's, you know, a lack of understanding of its importance. And I think that people don't really understand how important quality is. So they want to do preschool on the cheap. And if you do preschool on the cheap, you're not, you know, you get what you pay for. And you're not going to get the same kind of impacts. If you're having teachers who don't have any training in early childhood education, who haven't completed college, who aren't providing a developmentally appropriate curriculum, and are just drilling kids on counting from 1 to 10, they're not going to get the benefits of preschool at all.
How do African Americans and Latino Americans compare with one another and then with the population of European Americans and Asian Americans?
On the whole, I can tell you. It depends on which part of the index you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So overall, Latinos, the good news, first of all, I'm so grim all the time, so I'm going to start with some good news. Latinos have great life expectancy. So their life expectancy at birth is 83.5. So that's significantly above the national average, right? The national average life expectancy is 78.6. So Latinos are living significantly longer than the national average. Whites are living to 78.7. So Latinos are living, 5 years longer than whites, which is really fabulous. And in sort of public health circles, this phenomenon is known as the Latino paradox, because all around the world and for other racial and ethnic groups in the United States, the more educational attainment you have, the higher levels of education you've completed, the longer you live. That's a sort of statistical association that's really strong all around the world. But Latino Americans have the lowest levels of educational attainment of any racial and ethnic group, yet they have the second highest life expectancy, just after Asian Americans, who are living the longest at 87 years.
Let me have you pause there so we can take a break and we can get to the second part of this in just a minute. Kristen Lewis is my guest. She's co-director of the American Human Development Project and co-author of the new book, The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kristen Lewis, co-director of the American Human Development Project and co-author of The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So just before the break, Kristen, you were telling us about the Latino paradox, by which Latinos have the lowest level in this country of educational attainment as a group, but live quite a long time.
Yes, exactly. And so that's a very interesting phenomenon, and a lot of researchers are working on it to try to figure out what exactly is responsible for that, because that's something that really everyone can learn from, in a sense. You know, what are they doing right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a really promising area of research. On the flip side, in terms of a worrisome concern, though, is that African Americans are really living the shortest lives by a significant margin. So, you know, 87.3 for Asian Americans compared to 74.3, you know, 13 shorter years for African Americans on the whole. So in a sense, this is the life expectancy of the average American in the early 1970s. Hmm. So 4 decades or so of life expectancy progress have really bypassed African Americans, and that's a very serious concern.
What are the theories as to why African Americans have a shorter lifespan?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. I mean, I think some people automatically think of inner city situations where there's a high homicide rate among young men, and that's certainly one factor. But African Americans actually die from all causes at higher rates than whites do. And there are, again, a lot of reasons. One is differential access to health care. Another is, you know, stress and so forth, because African Americans are disproportionately lower income, so they're more likely to be in stressful jobs or in situations where they're not really securely attached to the labor market, which is stressful. Discrimination is stressful and causes a lot of stress. So all of these factors, I mean, the ways that you improve people's health really, again, is not medical treatments. It's the situations and conditions of people's daily lives. So if you look at, let's take Chicago, for instance. Chicago actually has the biggest gap. It's a 17-year gap between African Americans and Asian Americans in that city. And Chicago has the highest level of residential segregation by race of any city in the country. So it's really about what your daily life is like, the conditions of your daily life. Are you living in a safe neighborhood? Do you have access to healthy foods? Do you have secure employment? All these kinds of things are behind the differences in life expectancy.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jackie in Grapevine. Hi, Jackie. Okay, we don't have Jackie. Let's go to Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I had a question. I know you guys have moved on a little bit, but I called a little earlier about the universal pre-kindergarten that you had been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wanted the author to kind of comment on the idea that it seems pretty clear that the benefits of pre-kindergarten are really more about kind of behavioral, social issues than they are about, you know, learning your colors and numbers. And it seems if we legislate universal pre-K that we are kind of abdicating the role of parenting to teachers and kind of dumping a load on them that has traditionally been done by parents of, you know, when do you sit down, when do you stand up, how to be polite, how to kind of work in the environment with other people.
What do you think about that, Kristen?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point. I have to say that the U.S. is really alone among affluent democracies in feeling that sort of the responsibilities of society as a whole to children don't really kick in until they're 6 years old, you know, because in most states and in the country, it's not even mandatory that kids go to school until they're six. And all the other affluent democracies have a much more richly developed preschool system. And they really feel that it's, you know, the role of all of us to look out for kids and to provide kids the best possible start in life. And you know, some parents are just more able to do that. Lots of parents, you know, all parents basically, pretty much, with, you know, a few exceptions that are off the charts, most parents care tremendously about their children, and they want the very best that they can give to their kids. But parents vary very much in the ability they have to give the very best just because of their own resources they have. So parents with high levels of education and high incomes are able to put their kids in a great preschool, and are able to provide a really enriching home environment with developmentally appropriate toys, and that there's not a lot of stress maybe in the household because the income is secure, as opposed to parents who are struggling, who maybe have limited educational attainment levels themselves, who are under a lot of stress, who are working two jobs, who feel a lot of anxiety from living in a dangerous neighborhood. Those parents want the very best for their kids too. They just have fewer resources to provide it. And so there's a role for all of us. I mean, America is really about a fair shot for everybody. And that's why we have a public education system, is to create a level playing field so that everyone has an equal opportunity. And what the research is showing is that it's very hard for schools to provide that equal opportunity to kids when children are arriving on their first day of school with really different levels of school readiness and really different levels of sort of information and all sorts of things that make you able to succeed in school. So the research just supports the idea that to really create this equality of opportunity that all of us, all Americans believe in, we just have to push back the start of school a few years.
Are places where universal pre-kindergarten is available also requiring every child to attend?
That I don't know. You mean states in the United States?
Yeah.
No, I don't think there's any state that has a mandate.
Mm-hmm.
They have, you know, they have the availability, they have a commitment to produce it, but I don't think any state is requiring that kids. I might be wrong about that, and if I am, I hope someone will call up and tell us. But I don't think that's the case. I don't think any state has a requirement before five.
Okay, let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you? You know, it's the first time listening to your show, and thank you very much for having me.
Welcome.
You know, I really love this topic, and I tell you what, let's talk about collective parenting. I think the gentleman before was talking about, you know, how teachers need to take on a bigger responsibility and or role, or whether he agreed with it or not, I'm not sure. But they're taking on a big responsibility with kids, not just in teaching them education, but also teaching them about values in life and how to interact with each other. We see children nowadays, they got on the internet, you know, and they videotape fights. They don't talk well with their parents. They're looking for stimulation 90% of the time through television or, like she said, a video screen. And it's hurting America. It's hurting society. We need, as a whole, practice more collective parenting. I mean, you know, if you look back into the early, I think 30s, 40s, 50s, something like that, we went to church more. And I'm not saying that religion is the answer for those, because we all have different types of religion, but definitely a sense of caring, which will lead to an education, of course, paired together. Will lead to more respect.
Yeah, David,
better,
I think we got your point, and I really appreciate your call. Do you get the sense, Christian, that most Americans are concerned about the welfare of their neighbors or the people they don't necessarily know who live three blocks away?
You know, we don't have any research on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's overstated the degree to which Americans don't care about each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the climate right now is really political and really polarized, and that people sort of at either ends of the political spectrum are doing a lot of screaming at each other, and that creates the idea that Americans somehow are very, very divided. But I think when you actually look at people and the way they are in their daily lives, that they actually do care. And we would argue that, you know, 60% of Americans in the middle really, really care about these issues and would agree, actually, on most things. And it's a shame we don't focus on what we actually all agree on a bit more, because I think we could get more done that way.
We'd all like to live a long time, raise smart kids, and make decent money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are not highly contentious areas. I mean, how you achieve those ends, people have different ideas, but I think that we can all agree that these are aims we should be striving for.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Johnny in Dallas. Hi, Johnny.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, I remember the speaker said something about being unable to explain the longer life of Hispanics.
Uh-huh.
I remember reading a book some time ago called The Outliers, and one of the things they pointed out is that this Italian group lived longer because of the community impact, because of the closeness of the community, mm-hmm. and it kind of reinforced everyone. So she might want to look at that book.
Yeah, thank you so much. That is actually something that's come up very much in the research we've done for the book. For instance, Latina women have much lower instances of low birth weight babies, prematurity, and a lot of research has shown that the reason is that there's a lot of care given, you know, family care and community care given to Latina women when they're pregnant. There's a lot of knowledge in the community about how to take care of pregnant women and what they should eat, and there's you know, people make a lot of efforts on their behalf to take care of them, and that sort of social cohesion and caretaking behavior is one factor, and more research is pointing to the idea that there's something similar going on in terms of the longer life expectancy overall, that community bonds, that familial support, that all of these things are critically important, and, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because, again, the point we're arguing in the book is that it's the conditions of your daily life that really play the largest impact over for the average person on your health outcomes. And, you know, what's more important for the conditions of your daily life and the people you're living with than your neighbors around you and so forth?
What do we know about net worth in this country and how it relates to overall outcomes?
Well, our index doesn't include a measure of net worth because it's very hard to measure that. You know, there aren't really any surveys that get at net worth in
yeah.
the same way. There's one that's every 3 years. And also the value of people's net worth changes, right? You know, your house is worth one thing before the financial crisis and something very different
sadly,
now.
Sure.
But one thing we have seen is that net worth is actually tremendously important in a number of ways. First of all, getting back to that question of resilience, having assets, having some money in the bank and maybe owning your home and having access to credit, all these kinds of things, that's what really gets you through the tough times. So when you're sick, when you're out of work temporarily and so forth, you really draw on your assets, and that's what allows you to maintain your standard of living and not sort of just kind of fall through the bottom, in a sense, in terms of your life. It's also what allows you to invest in the next generation. You know, people who have assets are able to give their kids maybe a down payment on their first house, or they're able to pay for their college education, or they're able to ensure that a kid who's struggling in school gets the tutoring they need, and they're able to provide overall maybe a more conducive environment for just good outcomes for their kids. So those things are tremendously important. And what we've seen is that there is a huge and growing gap. So there's a big gap already in income, but the gap in wealth, in assets, is significantly larger than the gap in income. And, for instance, just to give you one example, between 1983 and 2007, the net worth of the top 1% of households, so in the income distribution, the very wealthiest Americans, the top 1%, their net worth went from about $9 million in 1983, $9 million to $18 million in 2007. So it doubled, the very wealthiest 1% of Americans. Whereas the bottom 40% of Americans, so, you know, 4 out of 10 American households, their net worth fell from $5,600 to $2,200.
Wow.
So right now we're in a situation where 40% of American families have assets of about $2,000. You know, how far is that going to get you when you lose your job, when you have huge medical bills? You know, it's and what kind of resources do you have to kind of invest in your children's long-term well-being? That's so much fewer. And, you know, you think about the GDP as a measure. You know, the GDP has tripled. As I said earlier, the GDP has tripled since 1974, but the median earnings of the average person have stayed pretty much flat. So, you know, this 1% of Americans, they're basically, you know, capturing all of that growth in GDP in terms of, and it's going to their own net, improving their own net worth.
So a takeaway from all this, and we have a very, very short amount of time left, prevention less expensive and more effective than crisis intervention?
For sure. I mean, problems are the cheapest, easiest, and most humane to stop before they actually happen. And, you know, that's something that we really emphasize throughout the book in everything, you know, in health rather than treating diabetes once it happens. It's a lot easier to stop it from happening, you know, through healthy diet and all these kinds of things. It's much better to invest in public health campaigns that keep kids from ever starting to smoke cigarettes.
And we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. I'm sorry. Kristen Lewis is director of the American Human Development Project, co-author of The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, Chris, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.